All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Joseph L. Falvey presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Falvey, and I'm joined by Judge Lauer on my right and Judge Jaquith on my left. We're convened today to consider the arguments in the matter of Stephanie Ortega versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 24-4799. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record.
Michal Leah Kanofsky and Tom Polsino for the appellant, Stephanie Ortega.
Thank you.
Kirsten Dowell, and to my right is Deputy Chief Counsel Carolyn Washington on behalf of the Secretary.
Thank you. We apologize for the delay today. I greatly appreciate your flexibility. Would Appellant's Counsel like to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve it.
Very well. We'll make that happen. If counsel are ready, we'll begin with Appellant's Counsel. Ms. Kanofsky, please proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. This case presents some issues of first impression in the AMA system. With respect to the evidence docket, the court should hold that under the plain language of 38 U.S.C. 7113C, the period to submit evidence begins when the board actually receives the 101A2. But pursuant to VA's own regulations meant to ensure due process, as codified in 38 CFR 3.110, if the board delays notifying the claimant of its receipt of the 101A2, then the time limit, meaning the end of the 90-day period, is calculated from the date that the board mails out the notification of receipt of the 101A2 to the claimant. With respect to 38 USC 5104B4, this court should hold that where the AOJ lists something unfavorable as a favorable finding, the claimant is harmed by being prevented from supporting her claims. In this case, the finding of preexistence was unfavorable, but because the rating decision listed it as a favorable finding, the appellant was not on notice that she should challenge that finding. She was told that it would help support her claim when it actually did the opposite. The effect of a 5104B4 finding, however, goes beyond the notice, as it also becomes binding on the board unless rebutted by clear and unmistakable evidence under 3.104 and 20.801A. So where a finding is unfavorable, instead of the board weighing the evidence to resolve reasonable doubt or the application of law to facts in favor of the claimant, it is applying a clear and unmistakable evidence standard to overturn an AOJ finding. Here, the AOJ applied the law on the presumption of soundness to appellant's facts, including three periods of service, with the last period nearly a decade after the first, and found that the 2008 report of medical examination meant the presumption of soundness did not apply to her 2017 period of service. But the board did not consider that question de novo or under the reasonable doubt standard because 20.801A put a higher burden on the board to rebut that application of law to facts.
Did the board discuss any of those principles?
Whether it was a favorable finding? I believe the board did say that the RO had found that the condition preexisted service. I do not believe that it discussed 3.104 or 20.801A in detail.
And does the veteran dispute the preexistence finding?
Yes.
Does the label that the RO put on it control, or is it controlling whether a finding is actually favorable or actually unfavorable? I mean, it's just the label they put on it. It could be an erroneous label, and that might present a different issue. But shouldn't that be what controls?
I think there are some cases where one could argue whether a finding is favorable or unfavorable, and that might be something to discuss on another day, but I cannot think of a circumstance where preexistence would be a favorable finding. And here the RO in the rating decision listed it as a favorable finding. So to the extent that, you know, 5104B4 says to list favorable findings and that they are binding, here it listed it as a favorable finding, but I don't think that there's any circumstance I can think of where preexistence is favorable.
Well, maybe not, but my point is that if the RO labeled it as such, labeled it as favorable, but everyone agrees that no, that's not a favorable finding, it shouldn't have been labeled there as that. It's not binding on the agency, that erroneous favorable finding.
I think I understand your question. I think what you're saying, if I could repeat it back to you to make sure I understand it, is that the board clearly understood that it wasn't favorable, so perhaps the board wasn't looking for clear and unmistakable evidence to rebut it, because the board, as an attorney familiar with veterans law, knew that it was an erroneously labeled favorable finding. So the impact might not have been on the board, the erroneous label. But I would still say that there's still that impact on my client, who doesn't know that she should be disputing that, because she is being told this is something good for you. It will support your claim, but in fact, it's not good for her. So when she gets that rating decision telling her this is favorable, she has no reason to understand the law well enough to know that actually, no, you should be challenging this.
Did she challenge it?
I don't believe that she raised arguments about it, specifically about the presumption of soundness. She presented her case. The evidence is what it is. As her attorney, when I'm reviewing the case, I am challenging it because there were three different periods of service. And between the second and the third period, there was that intervening VA-generated evidence from 2011 saying she did not have any of these foot conditions when examined. So I raised that for her to challenge it, as she was pro se before the agency. But had she understood that preexistence is not a favorable finding, then she could have raised arguments to the board saying, look, I served three periods of service. She could have raised arguments about the adequacy of the initial 2008 medical examination. But because she was explicitly told, this is good for you, this will help support your claim, she did not raise those arguments. And the purpose, one of the purposes of 5104B4 is also for a claimant to choose which lane in AMA they should go through. Had she known that this was unfavorable, perhaps she might have chosen a different review lane, asked for a higher level review, or submitted a supplemental claim with more evidence to show why she thinks the presumption of soundness, you know, should not apply in this way under these circumstances. So that would be the prejudice of this type of a notice error, even if it did not impact the board.
So, Ms. Knowski, if I understand correctly, then you are saying that the appellant could provide evidence to the AOJ that there was a clear and unmistakable error here. Am I misunderstanding that?
I think she could have made an argument to the AOJ that in this novel situation, the presumption of soundness should reapply for her third period of service anew, where there is that break in time between her first and second periods of service and her third period of service, that the preexistence prong shouldn't carry over from 2008, where you have this intervening VA-generated 2011 evidence saying she has no foot conditions whatsoever, and she was specifically examined for these conditions by a competent VA doctor. Also, her STRs were lost. She could have raised the argument that we simply don't know if there was another entrance report of medical examination closer in time to her 2017 period of service. And because we don't know that, carrying over this 2008 report of medical examination would not be fair because of the lost records issues. There were many things she could have raised with respect to the presumption of soundness had she been told, or had she not been told, that it was a favorable finding.
So you're asking the court to make a determination that the finding was, in fact, unfavorable, rather than, as stated, in the rating decision and not completely addressed in the board decision?
I believe, I cannot think of a circumstance where a finding of preexistence would be favorable to a claimant trying to claim service connection. Even were the claim to be granted, the finding of preexistence alone would impact how much benefits they could get because there would be that pre-service deduction. So, I mean, perhaps someone else could think of a circumstance where it would be a favorable finding. In this situation, I cannot think of any way that preexistence is favorable.
What if the theory of the case was only one of aggravation? Of a pre-existing condition.
Again, I still don't see why pre-existence would be favorable because if you didn't concede pre-existence, you would have, if it wasn't something noted on the entrance form, then the burdens of report of medical examination, then under Wagner, when you have those two prongs, the burden is on the government to overcome both of those prongs by clear and unmistakable evidence. Whereas if it's simply 1153, an aggravation claim, then the claimant still has that initial burden to show aggravation during service. So even if the claimant's theory of the case is, it pre-existed, but it got worse in service, it is still to the benefit of the claimant to have the presumption of soundness in place, even if the first prong could be rebutted by clear and unmistakable evidence, because the burden for the second prong of under Wagner would be on the government. So even in that situation, I'd say if it's not clear, if there's any way that the board could find the presumption of soundness in place, a finding of pre-existence based on a notation of a report of medical examination is not a favorable finding. Now, those might be the facts of the case, and it's certainly up to VA to determine the facts of the case, but those shouldn't be marked favorable.
It could be favorable in part in the sense that finding that a disability is pre-existing is a finding of a current disability.
I don't know that that would necessarily...
And that would be binding. You found that I had a disability. You said it was pre-existing. That's the unfavorable part. But the favorable part is I've got a disability. I win on that.
I don't know that necessarily a finding of pre-existence would meet, the level of a finding of a current disability. I believe, and I'm sorry, I cannot recall the name of the case, but there was recently a case about whether a healed injury from before service is considered, that had been completely healed before service, is that pre-existing or not? And the answer was that even if it had been resolved, it was still pre-existing. I think you can have pre-existence without meeting the current disability element. I think you would still need a separate finding of a current disability, not simply a finding of pre-existence.
Depends on the facts.
I think it would depend on the facts, but I would say in most circumstances, if you're going to find a current disability, then find that. I don't know that a finding of pre-existence necessarily also would fulfill a finding of a current disability. It certainly could, but, there are some conditions that can be intermittent or recurrent, and you could perhaps have a finding of preexistence where you also don't find a current disability. I could see that happening.
Yeah, but my point about that it's fact-dependent goes along with my point that does the label control or does reality control? Does it being actually favorable facts or circumstances of a particular case, is that control and not the label placed on it by the RO and then maybe acquiesced in by the board or ignored by the board?
I think the label controls with respect to the board, who one would assume knows the law well enough to know when the RO marks something favorable that isn't. But I think the harm, the purpose of 5104B is notice to the claimant. And I think that if a label is wrong, if the RO is telling someone, this is good for your claim, but in fact it is not, that has the natural effect of harming the claimant because she does not know how to properly support her claim, including which lane to choose, which arguments to make. So while the label doesn't control whether something is favorable or unfavorable, where the AOJ is labeling something unfavorable as favorable, then that would still violate 5104B because it goes to the purpose of those elements.
Anything else?
Question regarding the due process argument that the appellant makes, which has to do with the window for submitting additional evidence in support of a claim. Let's say for the sake of this argument and discussion that the claimant had interpreted the notice letter that VA sent in February of 2021 as starting the window. The evidence of record is that nothing was submitted within 90 days of that notice. So what would the, and the argument, of course, is that the claimant thought that the window had already closed, but what would the claimant have submitted during that? There's nothing in the record that indicates any attempt to submit anything, any request for clarification. And so
I think
been submitted during that time period.
I think what you're asking is how can I show prejudice if there was nothing that she tried to submit? And my answer would be, and to me, this is very reminiscent of Noah v. McDonald. I think that a person who gets a letter and reading that letter believes that they no longer have time to submit something, that would have the natural effect, a chilling effect of saying, oh, I guess I'm not allowed to do it. And I think that most people do not try to take actions that they deem futile. So on the day that she got the letter, to her knowledge, it was already too late. And she just says, oh, well, I guess it's too late for me. But I also think that she was reasonably waiting for notice that her 10182 had arrived because she mailed it in because of COVID, when there were, you know, it's generally known that there were delays in government during COVID. So her expectation was that she would be notified and then would submit evidence once she knew that it arrived. When she got the letter and she read it, to her knowledge, it was already too late. So to go to the effort of gathering that evidence to not have it be considered is a lot to ask from most people. Maybe someone would have done that, but most people don't ask for exceptions, don't ask for extensions. They accept the hand they're given. What I'm saying is that by VA's own regulations, the hand she was given wasn't fair, because VA has acknowledged that due process does require these types of notifications. And in the regulatory history for the evidence lane, VA said this very concern was raised, and VA said, we will notify claimants in accordance with our laws like we usually do. And unfortunately, that wasn't followed in this case. But the harm to her, the fact that she didn't submit evidence to me, is demonstrative of the harm, because she believed what she was told. She's not an expert. She doesn't know due process. She's probably not familiar with 3.110. So she doesn't know, oh, I'll submit evidence anyway, and my lawyer will make the argument later. No, she's just not going to submit evidence because she's getting a letter saying, well, now it's too late.
What evidence does she have to submit?
Well, I believe in the brief I mentioned some of the evidence that the AOJ had obtained a couple of years later, that had the evidence window still been open 90 days following the February 2021 letter to her, she could have submitted. I believe there was some evidence showing she was actually undergoing testing for chronic fatigue syndrome, which is she was undergoing testing for other conditions that could have been a differential diagnosis for her symptoms. I believe she also asked for a specific gel for her knee scar pain, which also goes to the denial of rating for her knee scar, because the board made a finding that it wasn't painful, but she asked for gel for that. So there was, I mean, I can't say with certainty everything she could have gathered in those 90 days and submitted, but just from the medical treatment records that we have from that 90-day period, there is evidence there that she could have submitted that would have supported her claims.
What if the board had sent notice on the 45th day instead of the 91st? Would that be sufficient timely notice?
I think that that would be a different fact pattern than the fact pattern that we have here. Now, I think that, again, under 3.110, the law should be that the board, from the date they send the notice, 90 days later, that window closes. And to the extent that the board is waiting 45 days, then the window stays open that extra 45 days. It opens with the 101A2. You wait 45 days. 3.110 says the 90 days closes 90 days after you send the letter. But that's not the circumstances we have in this case. And certainly that would be less sympathetic than what we have here. But I think the rule has to be that VA follows their own regulations, which VA has said they enacted in 1988 and 1990, the final rule, because that is how VA views due process, that you need to give people notification of time limits.
But you're asking for the notification of receipt of the NOD, right?
The receipt of the NOD.
So what's going to trigger the 90 days?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
And where's the statutory requirement for that sort of notice?
Again, sorry, I didn't mean to say again. I don't think I've answered this yet. I don't believe the statute requires it, and due process is the type of concept that applies differently in different circumstances. So here, I would say it's not the statute. It's VA itself that has recognized that this is what due process requires, and they recognized that in 1988, 1990. So even where a statute doesn't require something, an agency can take it upon itself to do more, and they have. And they have done that. They've announced that they believe that due process requires that when there's a time limit, you give notice of it. And they implicitly adopted that in the regulatory history to the AMA regulations when faced with this very question of how are claimants going to calculate evidence windows. The response in the legislative history was, we are not creating a new AMA regulation for that. We believe that the board already gives notice consistent with our laws and regulations. And I think that that was referencing 3.110, because that is the VA regulation that has to do with computation of time limits. And similar to how in Bilhars, for example, the court looked at 20.705B, but also looked at the regulatory history of how is VA going to be applying it to find that it incorporated the Bryant rules on a board member's hearing duties. Here, I think if we can look to that regulatory history where this very concern was raised, we can see that VA said, we are going to do what is consistent with our current practice. And the current practice is that 3.110 controls these types of time limits when based on when the notification letter is set out. So it is not a statutory issue. It is a regulatory due process issue.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The court should affirm the board's decision. Your Honor, starting with due process and the board's docketing letter, the court should affirm the board's decision because the AMA is all about choice. In this case, appellant chose the evidence submission docket. She chose not to submit evidence, and her counsel's own statement shows that appellant had actual knowledge of her 90-day window. Before we proceed, I would like to begin by clarifying a statement in the secretary's brief, which said that appellant pointed to evidence she submitted 2 years after receiving the board's docketing letter. That was not accurate. VATRs were associated with the file, but appellant did not submit any evidence at any point after submitting her NOD. Starting with appellant's choices, she chose the evidence submission docket when she filled out her 10-182. Next to the box she selected were the words, I have additional evidence in support of my appeal that I will provide within the next 90 days. The part of the form provided her with advance notice of her opportunity to submit any evidence that she would like to submit and the time to do so, the next 90 days. That was sufficient to provide meaningful notice and opportunity and satisfy due process. Nothing in
That's not the way the board defined the evidentiary record window, is it?
No, Your Honor. The board said that the appeal was received by the board about 10 days later after it was mailed. While receipt generally goes by the postmark rule, it is case-by-case specific. It is a finding of fact. And here it is not disputed that the clock started on November 5th, with receipt.
The but 90. The board didn't tell anybody that. The board just said that in the appeal, in their resolution of the, excuse me, in their resolution of the matter on appeal to us, and in their February 2021 letter, that the board would only consider evidence submitted with the veteran's NO date or within 90 days after they received it, not after the veteran signed it or sent it or faxed it. Although I guess because faxing contemplates immediate receipt by both parties, Davis governs, but doesn't have any application to this case, does it?
Davis does apply to this case, Your Honor. Davis makes clear that the 90-day clock does not start on the notice letter or the docketing letter that the board generates. Yes, Davis is directly applicable.
Doesn't Davis say that only in the context of the facts of that case, where the express holding of the court was, it's settled, acknowledged by all, that if I fax you a document, when that document is received by your machine, you have it and I have it. We know. That's right. Not true when it's mailed. Was there any way for the veteran to know when VA received her NOD?
Your Honor, generally receipt does go by the postmark rule. Cases like Savitz and even oral argument in Davis acknowledge that it is generally the postmark. An appellant would know when she went and placed her NOD in the mail. We do not read Davis as being so limited only to facts as to say that any other method of submission, whether it's an electronic upload through e-benefits or through the postal service, would go by the docketing letter rather than the actual receipt. 7113C is clear.
If that's VA's interpretation, why send a notice at all?
The docketing letter, Your Honor, is sent to for multiple reasons. It informs claimants on the ability to request advancement on the docket, how to request a change in representation, how to change dockets. It confirms that the appeal was actually docketed. The purpose of the letter is not to say your 90-day clock starts today.
It's the first thing it says.
Her letter says that it has received her 10-182 and her appeal is placed on the board's docket, and she has 90 days from receipt to submit evidence. But the letter did not tell her when her appeal was actually received by the board. And
is that the flaw in the letter? I mean, if it had said, and it was received on November 4th, she would know, I have no more time. Or maybe it said November 15th, and I've got to really move here because I'm running out of time.
Well, Your Honor, in this instance, page one of appellant's reply brief states, by the time she received the February 2021 letter, to her knowledge, it was already too late to submit any evidence, which shows that she actually knew, based off of the advance notice VA applied, within the next 90 days, she knew when her clock started and when her clock ended. And if there was any negligible difference of just a few days, she still didn't submit any evidence. She didn't aim for day 90 and miss by an inch because she didn't fire the arrow at all. And even if, based on the sort of different version of events that come from the opening brief, when she said the letter spoke as if appellant could still take action when she received the letter, if that were true and she believed that the letter was what started the 90-day period, she did not rely on that to her detriment. So either way, the notice was effective, it was meaningful, it was reasonable, and she was not harmed.
She was not harmed because in that 90-day period after that docketing letter, she didn't submit anything?
Well, Your Honor, she was not harmed because her due process rights were not violated. And even if there were any sort of confusion, she had that actual notice. And it's It's the actual knowledge that an individual have. Cases like Saunders v. Nicholson or Vasquez Flores v. Peek explain that a notice error may be rebutted and the prejudice of a notice error may be rebutted specifically by showing that the error was cured by actual knowledge on the part of the claimant. And that
except the form and the board's letter gave different periods of time.
Well, Your Honor, the letter did not.
And the board has been very miserly or specific about the time frame, so that if it's submitted too early, no good. Too late, no good. Right within the 90 days. And so for this veteran, the 90 days was a moving target.
Your Honor, the date of receipt and the 90-day period is a finding of fact that appellant is free to dispute. The board can analyze on a case-by-case basis, and the court can look at on a case-by-case basis. But here she does not dispute what her 90-day period was.
What do you make of Ms. Konofsky's regulatory due process argument that she indicates that VA took on a duty to apparently provide notice of receipt? What's your response to that?
Your Honor, the docketing letters are not to the primary purpose of the docketing letter is not to notify or confirm receipt. The notice is provided in advance on the 10-182. The board's docketing letter is imperfect, but even if that imperfection rose to the level of not satisfying the requirements of due process, there would still be no harm here. Appellant had that actual knowledge, and she foregoed her opportunity to submit evidence.
Except the form is wrong about the time frame. The statutory language and the regulatory language is the language the board used, that the date, the clock starts to tick upon their receipt of the NOD. And in these circumstances, the only way for the veteran to know when the board has received the NOD is for the board to tell the veteran.
Your Honor, the statute says within receipt, cases like Sovitz explained that receipt goes by generally the postmark rule, but that is a finding that can be disputed with a case-by-case analysis. And the form that she filled out specifically said within the next 90 days. And Congress enacted the AMA to fix problems in the legacy system, which limited the evidentiary window to ensure that timely review. And to have adopting appellant's position, starting the 90-day clock upon the mailing of the docketing letter, that would not only contravene Congress's intent and 7113C, but it would create an unworkable, inequitable system. Even if there were that due process error, even if the court were to disagree, it would not be prejudicial. Looking at the different evidence that appellant asserts she could have submitted, the VATRs, only two of those pieces of evidence were within the actual 90-day window. The remaining evidence, as opposing counsel is aware, came in from after the 90-day window closed. An appellant therefore had notice and opportunity and chose not to submit evidence. Therefore, there is no error, there is no prejudice, and remand on this argument is not warranted. The second issue here is whether a remedy is warranted when the AOJ's favorable findings include the finding that appellant's foot conditions are pre-existing conditions. No remedy is warranted here. Your Honors, there are two relevant theories of entitlement, one on a direct basis and one on a theory of aggravation. An appellant's argument hinges on conflating the elements of those two theories. One favorable finding by the AOJ here was that the foot conditions existed prior to service, which is favorable within the context of a theory of aggravation. It satisfies one of the elements for entitlement, and to succeed under that theory, appellant no longer has to prove preexistence, she only has to prove aggravation. However, the other theory of entitlement is direct service connection. That claim has different elements. And in that context, preexistence is not favorable. Preexistence does overlap both of those theories, but it does not bind the board when it is unfavorable or not an element of that claim. And it does not prohibit the board from addressing other theories of entitlement. The board did not treat the AOJ's finding of pre-existing conditions as binding on the determination of direct service connection because it independently reached the same correct conclusion based on the statutory presumption of soundness. The board reviewed the November 2008 entrance exam, which clearly documented both foot conditions at the time of enrollment. Under 38 U.S.C. 1111, the presumption of soundness does not attach to a condition noted on the entrance exam. The entrance examination controls. Direct service connection on that theory or basis is not warranted, and that shifts the focus to aggravation, which the board then addressed. And indeed, the AOJ's favorable finding of preexistence also placed the analysis in that realm of aggravation. So there was no error here.
The board didn't address the regional office's finding at all, did they?
The board noted, Your Honor, that the AOJ found the condition was pre-existing, but it noted or acknowledged that after it made its initial finding that the presumption of soundness does not attach because of the November 2008 entrance exam.
It didn't address whether it was favorable or unfavorable, so there's no way for us to know whether that what the regional office said had any impact on the board's decision.
Your Honor, it did not address whether that was a favorable finding or how that strictly worked into its analysis explicitly. However, even if there were an error or an imperfection in the board's reasons or bases, no remand is warranted. Appellant relies on 38 CFR 20.802A, which has two parts. Two distinct clauses. The first pertains to duty to assist errors and is a shall remand, which is not relevant here. The second clause gives the board discretion to remand to correct other statutory or regulatory errors by the AOJ, but only if correction of that error would have a reasonable possibility in substantiating the claim. So even if the court were to find that the board erred, remand would still not be warranted. A reasonable possibility of aiding and substantiating a claim, that condition is not met here. Remanding to the AOJ simply to remove an unfavorable finding from the list of favorable findings is a futile exercise that would merely spin the hamster wheel of litigation. It would not aid in substantiating the claim because the AOJ would merely delete the finding from the list, and the board would once again look at the November 2008 entrance exam, which dispositively shows that the presumption of soundness does not attach. Therefore, no remedy is warranted.
But that question is pretty complicated in this case, given the number of the separate active duty periods. Shouldn't that have been discussed as part of the board's effort to establish the baseline of severity of these conditions and determine whether preexistence, if it ever applied to the last of the active duty terms?
Your Honor, 38 U.S.C. 1111 looks at the entrance examination and determining whether the presumption of soundness attaches. But with appellant's three periods of service, there were, I believe it was about 3 months in between her first and second period of service, which there would not have been a second entrance exam before that second period of service. In between the second and third period of service, she was in the reserves. So she would not have had a full enlistment or enrollment examination before that third period of service.
But she did in that period of time have a VA examination that concluded that she did not have any foot abnormalities, correct?
She did, Your Honor. That is correct. But the condition does appear intermittently throughout the record, beginning with the entrance examination, to include that appellant said that her condition actually onset in 2009, just a few months after the entrance examination, but it does appear intermittently throughout the record.
Well, you know, there's structural things, but the question is whether they're disabling.
Your Honor, the condition does appear intermittently. It was noted upon entry. At this point, the question would be whether that condition has worsened or aggravated beyond its natural progression.
Yeah, but by the condition, you're talking about the impairment. You know, if you, when you have flat feet, like I do, it's the same as having a nose, right? It's, I have it all the time. Whether it's disabling or not might vary. But that's why it's important that the board considered the whole spectrum of the evidence in this case, including the findings that the regional office made.
Your Honor, the statute about whether or not the presumption attaches does say that if the condition is noted on the entrance examination, the presumption of soundness does not attach. If we are looking at aggravation, intermittent reports of whether or not she had the condition would only show that the condition continued to persist, not that the condition was aggravated. And Your Honors, in both of appellant's arguments, she has not met her burden of establishing any error, let alone prejudicial error. We ask the court to affirm the board's decision, and we thank you for this opportunity. I welcome any additional questions.
In the secretary's reply brief, he refers to the AOJ's finding that appellant's foot conditions existed prior to military service as, quote, arguably unfavorable. Your opponent this afternoon used the term of that being a conceding the arguably unfavorable. How would you describe that phrase being used in the reply brief with respect to the pre-existing foot conditions?
Your Honor, the favorable findings are contextual. So when the AOJ is making a favorable finding, they are essentially checking the different boxes for the elements of a claim, and there's different theories. So under the aggravation theory of entitlement, it is a favorable finding. But under a direct service connection, where we're looking at entirely different elements, that is arguably unfavorable. But the pre-existing condition or the favorable finding more generally exists within the context of a particular theory of entitlement. So what may be favorable in under one theory may not necessarily be favorable under another theory, and in those other theories, it would not be binding upon the board.
So that goes back to the earlier statements that you made in terms of the two prongs, one being service connection, one being aggravation. So in that context, the secretary would differ in saying that that's not a concession.
Correct, Your Honor.
The term.
Yes, so it is contextual.
Thank you.
And the label doesn't matter.
The label of the heading in this instance, Your Honor, does not matter because we have that entrance examination, which is dispositive. It's clear that is what is in the statute. And even if the AOJ were to go delete that from underneath that heading or were to change the heading in any way, it would not change the outcome because we have the entrance examination.
How are we to conclude that there's no prejudice from the notice defects here without engaging in fact-finding, since the record includes both an Army Records Processing Center certification in June of 2019 that the veterans' service treatment records are absent? And our record has 200 pages of service treatment records covering a 14-year period, including records all around the February 2021 board letter confusing the evidentiary record window.
Your Honor, VA made reasonable attempts to obtain those service treatment records. And opposing counsel did not argue that there was a pre-decisional duty to assist error regarding those service treatment records. So in terms of the factual finding itself, that there was no prejudice, that is evidenced in page one of the reply brief, in which opposing counsel said, by the time appellant received the February 2021 letter, to her knowledge, it was already too late to submit evidence. That shows her personal knowledge. Sanders v. Nicholson explains that prejudice can be rebutted by showing that the
error... Doesn't that just show that she understood the contents of the letter?
No, because the letter does not actually say, Your Honor, it's too late. It did not say this is when the clock started. She had that knowledge with the letter that specifically says, we've received your NOD. It's been placed on the board's docket, and you have 90 days from our receipt to submit evidence. By her counsel's own statement, she knew it was already too late, which shows that she had actual knowledge at the time that she received the letter, if not before she received the letter, because the letter does not actually tell her it was too late. That's her personal knowledge, which shows that there was no prejudice, even if there were an error, and that actual knowledge can be established by statements or actions by a claimant or a claimant's representative that demonstrate an awareness. That comes from Vasquez Flores v. Peak, 22 Vet App 37, page 48 from 2008.
What are we to make of the board's decision to send the notice letter the day after the evidentiary record window expired?
Your Honor, it's unfortunate that the docketing letter was sent out so late. That happens because of a variety of reasons outside of the board's control. We don't know exactly why that happened here. We do know it was during the time of COVID. But factors that can influence how quickly the board can send out a notice letter apply or range from staffing, whether it's a busy time of year, the volume of appeals coming in, holidays. There's a lot of things that can affect that, Your Honor.
So we're to believe that it was coincidental?
There's no indication that this was malicious, Your Honor, or that there was an intentional delay.
Doesn't the board providing accurate notice of the evidentiary record window, that is, that it starts on receipt and not on signing the appeal form, after the time has expired, deprive the veteran of due process?
No, Your Honor, it does not deprive the appellant of due process. It is a fact-specific determination on a case-by-case basis as to when the 10-182 is actually received by the board. So if it were, in certain instances, the postmark rule may not be what is most advantageous to a veteran. And in that case, the veteran can raise that argument or contest the effective date or can contest the date of receipt. And in a situation such as that, if she had sent in something on day 91 because the board started with one date and ended with another, then we may have had a different result if the facts were different. But that isn't the case here.
But what is the case is that the first accurate notice was sent after the evidentiary window had expired. So there's... Since notice and opportunity to be heard are the core requirements of due process, to the extent the veteran got accurate notice, it was after the opportunity to be heard expired. But that's a due process violation.
But, Your Honor, she was provided that notice in advance when she filled out her form.
You keep saying that, but that the form does not have the notice that's specified by statute or VA's own regulation.
Even if there were, Your Honor, a due process violation, by her own knowledge, she knew when her time was up, which means there would be no prejudice here in this case.
Anything else? No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
few points I want to make. First of all, it was emphasized certain statements in the reply brief, such as to her knowledge, it was too late. So I want to point out two things there. One, the situation in, forget the full name of the case, Vasquez, with regard to the 5103 paragraph A notice violations where the veteran had a representative, that was a representative before the agency. I was not Ms. Ortega's representative before the agency. I was not involved in the case until it was appealed to this court. So to the extent that one could say, oh, well, the representative had knowledge, she was pro se in front of the agency. She had a VSO, but that has been acknowledged to be equivalent to being pro se, not to having attorney representation. So I don't believe that the actual knowledge, inquiry would go towards my knowledge once we're on appeal to the court to impute that to her before the agency.
I'm not following them. It was in your reply brief, though, right?
Yeah, it was in my reply brief that a reasonable person who mailed in a 10182 on October 27th, where it arrived at the board on November 5th, and then got a letter in February that was mailed to her in February, might not have arrived to her until mid-February. That person, on receiving a letter that says, what's next? You have 90 days from the date of receipt, would likely remember, oh, yeah, months ago, I put that in the mail. Oh, okay, I guess it's too late. That is what I thought a reasonable person. Now, I will say, and this was also in the reply brief, she did proffer that had it said on the letter, you have 90 days from the date of this letter, then she would have submitted the evidence. She was waiting for the letter of receipt. Because again, and I would also reply with respect to this postmark rule, I believe that Davis held that the statute says that receipt is when the board gets it. And if there is a finding of fact of whether receipt means the postmark, that makes it all the more important to send the letter, because otherwise, how does the veteran know how the board is interpreting those 90 days? When do they start and when do they end? She mailed it out on October 27th, but the board didn't receive it until November 5th. So if we're going to have findings of fact as to when receipt is, then it's all the more important that those findings be made and the veteran be notified of them before, you know, we start that, before we calculate when that 90-day window is going to end. Davis was also about a receipt date. Davis did not address VA's duties to notify under 3.110. It was about whether or not, what does it mean that the board receives something? What the argument is in this case, which is distinct from Davis, is that VA has separately put upon itself a duty. It is acknowledged under due process that it will give notice of time periods. And also, since Davis, the court has come out with Bolds. And in Bolds, the court held that 7113C windows are waivable. So the argument here is that, yes, the board received it on November 5th. And that is when the window opened. But it waived that strict 90-day time limit until 90 days after it sent notification of the time limit. That is where the waiver is. And I would say that that hasn't even happened to this day. The remedy that I would want is that this court would remand it to the board to send her a letter saying you have 90 days from the date of this letter, because she has still been harmed. Even if you were to remand this case back to the board, unless she gets that 90-day window, she is still harmed by this because she did lose that opportunity. Yes, the form said any evidence you can mail in within 90 days of mailing in this letter, but that was not accurate information. And Cook, the court held that it is the date that the NOD is received by the board, not the postmark date, the date that it's received by the board. So unless she's mailing in a stack of evidence with the 10182, she doesn't know that a letter she mails in a week later is going to arrive before or after her 10182 arrives. Now, with respect to whether she should have mailed in a stack of evidence with the 10182 to be very certain, I would say that to expect veterans to do that is almost to take away the 90 days altogether and just say, mail in your evidence with the 10182. But that's not what Congress devised. Congress said, you get 90 days, not you can mail in one package together to be extra certain. And that is why notice is required, because if we're going to make a finding of fact of receipt, People need to know when that clock started. And I don't think that it was Congress's intent in enacting 7113C to trick people. Yes, she had choices, but she also needed to know certain facts, like when the board got her 10182, or even if it arrived. She needs to know that it actually arrived there before she could be expected to be gathering this evidence and submitting it.
Great, thank you. I'd like to thank both counsel for your arguments and for your briefs, and this case is now submitted.